Hello, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for joining, whether it's live or recorded. We're in another talk of relational aid, whatever works, practical skills for couples in wartime. My name is Dr. Asel Romanelli.
Malik Romanelli.
And together we run.
Own your shit.
And we help couples remarry each other. We help people own their shit, turn their shit into fertilizer. And since the war began in Israel, we have opened a relational home front where we do free webinars and try to help couples in Israel and around the world and practical skills to not only survive, but thrive. And today it is my honor to introduce Alan Marriott, who I'm going to briefly read his introduction, then I want to share a story about him that he doesn't know. I'm going to share it. So Alan Marriott has a career spanning improvisation, music, acting for stage, film, and television, coaching, voiceover acting, creativity training, and global language and dialect exploration. He's a popular motivational speaker and creativity consultant for brands and corporates. He regularly performs in London and throughout Europe with Grand Theft Intro.
Yeah.
Nice. Saturday Night Fever. That's great. His debut book on creative thinking and improvisation sums up his message. It's genius now. And I want to share a personal story. So when I was living in London many years ago, about 17 years ago, I was single, miserably single, and probably clinically depressed. And I would go to these drop-in improv classes, the Flux improv classes.
Oh, yes.
It's an East London, some community center. And Alan was teaching drop-in improv classes, and he was just writing his book. So he was like the mad professor spitting out his Torah, his teaching. And I was like writing everything down, following him, writing it down. And then he left London, and he published his book, Genius Now. And it is a genius. He's a brilliant mind. And when I started my doctorate, which was teaching therapists at Improvise, I went back to his book, and I've been teaching your teachings, Alan, for many, many years.
Yeah, I need to give you another one. It's getting worn out.
And I wanted to say something, and this is on a personal note. You're the first improviser that we've hosted here.
Oh.
And for me, bringing improv and therapy together, I know improvisation. I'm reminding everyone, therapy, art, and education are one. They used to be all connected. The shaman, you know. Right? And we've separated those disciplines. And I am so happy. I want to really thank you, Alan, for saying yes and agreeing to be with us. And I'm sure this is going to be a different type of talk, because today we're not talking to a therapist, we're talking to an improviser. It was all about collaboration, equal creativity. And Alan, so first of all, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here, Asael, and Galit. I don't know what to say. I've been doing improv for like 1,000 years and teaching it as well, and it just keeps growing. It's one of those things that once you get started on it, you really can't let it go. And I've always felt that improv has a big role to play socially, yeah. not just for couples, but also just for bringing people together in general. And that as you know from reading the book, that my big thing is about trying to build improv thinking, you know, trying to let that spread worldwide, because I just think it's a force for good, just having people connect. I really do believe that that improv has an underlying wonderful thing about it, which is that ability to connect people together. Because I think we live in a world that has become so disconnected, and all of the devices that we have surrounded ourselves with actually help us to disconnect, even though, you know, we talk about social media, but really it's anti-social media. You know, it's actually not helpful at all in many respects. And what we need to do is to start really, really connecting with people on a personal level, not just on an electronic level. I mean, this is great and it's important, but it's that personal level, that because that's where you actually feel energy movement. You know, when you do a Zoom class with somebody, there is a disconnect between your energy and the energy of the people who are watching. Yeah. And it's not quite the same as doing a true class. So I've started and so, COVID couldn't have come at a worse time in many respects for the world. And most of the problems that are bubbling up now, in a way, are they're like an aftershock of the pandemic.
Yeah.
This is a classic thing that happens about every 100 years, where you have, you know, things that shake up everything.
Yeah.
And so it's not a surprise that COVID has led to all of these terrible things happening, and you're like right in the middle of one. And,
yes.
You know, Ukraine is in the middle of one, and the U.S. is about to explode into something I don't even want to think about, you know, but with the rise of Trump and all that. And it's all about disconnection. See, I don't think that there's anything, I don't think that there's such a thing as good and evil. I think that there is only connection and disconnection. And that the more you disconnect, the more you do evil things. Mm-hmm. And the more that you connect, the less harm you cause people. Yeah. Because if you connect to people, you feel their pain and you can't, it hurts you as much as it hurts them. So it's so really all of that comes from connection and disconnection. So we really have these two. To me, it's the world is actually kind of, it's almost like Einstein, right? It's like I'm doing a fight theory, everything, right? So we go from the idea of connection and disconnection as those two polarities, and then the two polarities that there are really only two emotions, fear and love. And fear leads to hate and anger and all of the other things that are there. And love, again, leads to this upward-outward movement, which connects people together. And we can use our own tendencies and our own temperaments of stuff that we have. And as long as we're working in that upward-outward way, I talk a lot in my book about upward-outward thinking,
right,
as a way to as a way to view the world, as a way to approach the world.
I'm thinking really, couples now are in survival mode. When I'm in survival mode, I'm not open. I'm not vulnerable. I'm not thinking relational. I'm thinking just
yeah. Me.
And it's really hard for couples right now.
It's awful. So what do we do? I think part of it is making more time. Just making more time, because it's so easy to get caught up in the other stuff that's all around you because it's so loud. The making that time, first of all, is the first part about it. Yeah. It's kind of like today I actually just made time to be with my partner. Like we created half an hour to just be together, just, you know, just cuddle for half an hour. And that's like, and then there's something that rekindles. So there's something that ignites again, just even doing that, because energy flows back and forth, and then you get, and you start to yes and each other again. You know, we really start to get.
Is the cardinal rule of improv. We'll just say it for this. I'm assuming a lot of our viewers didn't take an improv class. Yes.
So when I talk about yes and, what I really mean by that is not, it's not just agreement. It's an actual system of encompassing all of what someone else gives you as an offer, so that you take it on board and you add it to what you have, rather than, so there's a lot of people in improv misinterpret yes and someone will come in and give them something and say, okay, we're now in a church, or we're now in a school or whatever, and whatever they've had before that, they'll throw that away and then go with that new thing. As opposed to, no, the magic of existence is taking that thing that somebody's giving you and combining it with what you have. It's the combination of the two things that makes the magic in both improv and I think in
relationships
and ideas in general, you know.
Right.
You know, so if I'm working with marketers or whatever, and we're talking about this stuff, you don't throw out that's the good idea. Oh, that's It's like there's a part idea here and a part idea to there. And by combining them together and finding what the link is between them is where the magic happens.
Mm, you know,
if you think about it, what is a joke but two lateral ideas where you found the link between them and you've done, the audience gets the punchline just before they put it together. Right. Yeah. So that
it's like a synthesis of like the commonalities, right? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
exactly.
I think what's common in both of these, like, why did this person throw out that idea and that idea?
Yeah.
Oh, well, here's like a kernel that connects them both. What did that create? Did I get that right?
Yeah. Totally.
I'm thinking, Alan, because we know, like, right now in wartime, our relationship is our biggest resource. And a lot of couples right now having difficulty to yes and each other and to co-create, right?
So I think there's some interesting things that go with this. And that is like, what are your, we really need to talk about status here and status habits, I think.
Yes.
Because status is, so status is basically the smallest indicators of dominance and submission that we give to each other. And it's an agreed activity. It's a dance, okay? Status is a dance. It's not a, I'm high and you are low. It's not that, you know, it's not like I am king and you are a servant. It's not that at all. It's a dance where it goes up and down. Keith Johnston, the great teacher Keith Johnston used to talk about this as a seesaw that goes up and down. And the movement of it is what makes it not just interesting to watch and play, but fun. Okay. Right. Keith used to say the people that we have as partners and friends are people who we've agreed to play certain status games. And I think that's so beautiful because it's like, and the games are really powerful. The main, like the main kind of status games that we have are like a topping thing, right? So some people, sometimes you have a friend that you just love to have topping games with, and you'll be in a pub or whatever, and you'll go, yeah. And you'll say, did you know that, blah, blah, blah. And the other guy will go, yeah. Well, yes, but did you also know? And then, oh, yeah, did you know that? And I think you'll find, right? And then it'll end up in a, oh, well played. Well, right? So you get, you know, it's a, and then, oh, yeah, nul point, right? Right, and then it'll be like that. And then the opposite of that is like the lowering game, which you often see in places like kind of like old folks' homes where they are competitively ill with each other. Right. You know, like, oh, yes, I had my hip done. Oh, just only the one. I had both my hips done, you see. And it was awful. And I had Dr. Spink. Dr. Spink is so much better than my doctor, you know. With competitively lowering myself next to the other person. And that is, again, can be a really fun game that people play with each other. Yeah. So, and then beyond that, we have things like often things like a transfer where one person will start at a higher status position and the other person will start at a lower position. And then throughout the moment, they'll change that attitude. Also, something really interesting about couples and families is that oftentimes the public face that you show as a couple has one status relationship going, and then when you're in private, it reverses.
So it's interesting because in the clinic, I mean, this is our clinic, we do couples therapy. Well, I'm in notice hierarchy where one today we have, he thinks he's smarter than her. She one downs herself, he ones up, and they're both running away from intimacy connection.
Yeah, sure.
So you're saying we can use status from the improv world to help these couples kind of connect on a,
when you understand what you're doing with status, it really makes a big difference. So we can't really talk about status without also talking about physical orientation.
Right.
So for instance, if you just stand up for a sec, okay, right? You stand and say, adjust the camera so we can see you both. Okay, so at the moment, Galit is slightly higher status than you are. Because
what made you say that?
Because A, you're a half step in front of him. You're not looking back to check that he's looking at you, right? He is checking to look at you every now and then. So it's clearly giving you a slightly higher. Yeah, there, right there. See, he's lowered his status right there, just by checking, right? So this is a really powerful thing, is status checking behavior. Now, I noticed you guys both flinched like, oh, I'm not high status. That must be awful. And it's not. Okay. Low status is just as powerful and just as useful as high status. And we mustn't think that one is good and one is bad. It's not so. Okay. Because there is absolutely no way that you can reach agreement And I don't even mean compromise. I mean agreement, where you combine things together unless you understand how low status works. That it's not some sort of a handicap. It's actually an incredibly helpful tool.
Yeah. Do you find a gender correlation here that men will usually be in heterosexual relationships?
Okay, so there
are we sitting or standing?
Sitting or
stay standing for just a minute for me. Okay, stay standing for just a minute. So let's say if we want to make your status transaction, just even the way you are, more acute, turn to face each other a little bit more. Okay, Galit is still higher status than you are, because your shoulders lowered. You did a little jiggle. Your head wobbled, and she was like, "No, sit still, right?" It was really cool. So it's like, what we're not talking maximum status gaps here, and it doesn't matter whether one's higher or lower, really. You have to be. We're always a little bit higher or a little bit lower than the other person. Recognizing that, and not the key to status transaction is agreement. If my status is adjusted against my will, I experience anxiety and pain.
So this is the key issue here
is, if you lower someone's status against their will, they experience pain, anxiety, and will move towards anger and aggression.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in couples, from your experience, how do they lower each other?
Really simple things. Okay. So you and Galit, imagine that you and Galit are just kind of angling towards the camera. So angle towards the camera now. And I want you to start a little speech, and then Galit, I want you to interrupt him. Okay, so start.
That's every conversation we've ever had.
No, but I just want you to watch it from a status angle. Okay, so start a little speech, Asael. I want you to talk about something innocuous, you know, like something that bothered you today. Something that bothered you that's quite innocuous. That's not really, it's not a big deal. It's a little thing, right?
Okay.
So I'm going to share this with everybody.
We're owning your shit. I'm going to use the real example.
Okay.
Adam was doing too well, and I'm a bit sick today. Yeah. And when you took Lila to swimming.
I know I made you tea with the lemon.
Yeah, but actually, I want to ask you, though. Yeah, but I wanted to say to Lee, who the asses I won't.
So now, Galit,
yeah.
When you interrupt him, touch his arm.
Okay.
Okay. So keep your arms kind of keep them in front of you and crossed, Asael. So when you interrupt, touch his forearm. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So when you took Lila to swim, I was hoping you'd make dinner. I didn't want to make dinner. I wanted you to make dinner because I'm not paying.
I know. And you didn't need to make dinner.
So Galit. So when you touch his arm, that's when you interrupt. Wait for him to half finish a thought beat, then interrupt him by touching his arm and interrupt him.
Okay.
So when you took Lila swimming, I'm not feeling too well. I was hoping you were going to make dinner tonight.
I know.
No, you got to touch him right away. Touch him and spank. Yeah. Because you went grab and then, but it's touch him and talk. So it's like clawing at him and then speaking to him. Okay.
Okay. Right?
Yeah. Watch how strong this transaction is, folks.
Okay. So I wasn't chilling today. I wasn't feeling well. When you took Lila swimming, I was kind of hoping you'd make dinner because I'm exhausted.
No, but what did I do it right?
You did. That was perfect. Okay. Yeah.
I know you didn't want to make dinner, but she didn't want what was an offer. So
well, I was hoping, I'm sick, but I was hoping you'd take care of the cake so I don't have to cook.
Then interrupt him again.
I understand what you said.
Okay. Can you feel how much more that? Yeah.
So and he's grown taller than her. I'm taller than her.
Height makes no difference.
I really feel like I'm bringing him, like I'm pulling him down.
So here's the really interesting thing is that we have these planes of power, that come out from our shoulder blades at 45 degree angles, okay? Now think of yourself like a lighthouse, right? That's your light. That's your energy light that goes forward, okay? Goes out from your shoulders. So anybody that stays in that plane there, so it's really interesting. Right now, you've angled yourself so that SIL is in that plane of influence. Do you know that?
I'm not embarrassed.
No, because you just step back.
No, because you step back, right? Stepping back is a way to try and regain control. But actually, yeah. Yeah, do you see? So when she's angles herself to be there, it's a way to maintain high status. It puts you in, it's basically a classic master-servant situation, okay? But, right, and but what is a master-servant situation in reality, okay? It's not incompetency.
Right.
Okay? A good master-servant situation is where both parties are getting something out of the deal, all right? If I'm in a low-status position to somebody else, if being with that person actually elevates me and supports me, then I'm getting something out of this relationship.
Right.
And the same is as if I'm a high status person and I'm with this person who's slightly lower than me, then I'm getting this confidant that I could trust who will always have my back. When relationships go wrong is when the one of those people that's in that situation stops liking that game.
Right.
If the game begins to change, that's when relationships start to break down. Okay.
Now with the war.
Wait a minute. I want to ask a question about that. So is it when they start to change? I do it naturally.
Did you not know she was the higher status?
No, I didn't know. I thought I was close.
I also thought I was the high status.
Oh my God.
Well, that's brilliant. That's nice.
That is patriarchal.
I do this with other people who I'm not married to also. I grab their arms and...
Of course you do. Of course you do.
Maybe because it's like
that. It's a tool. Go on, ask your question, Glee. That was awesome, guys. That was really awesome.
I like the idea of kind of like the playing and that transactional is, but we're both getting something out of it, right?
Yeah.
Reciprocity, or I guess kind of thing.
Well, it's more than that, Galit. It's actually also that there's pleasure to be had from playing those status games. This is what I mean. You see, the thing is that if I play status games with people and I enjoy playing those games with them, and we always play status games with people, and it's the ones that where we have trouble and we have problems and conflict is because they're not playing by the rules.
Right.
Okay, so they're not playing by the rules, or they're not
flexible in their status.
Right, they're not playing the up and down. They stay where they are, and they're like,
yes, it's not just up and down, because you might be really low status too and keep pulling somebody down. Right, it works both ways. So it's not just, admittedly, but this happens a lot in office situations. I've lost count of the amount of times when I've worked with people who are in, you know, corporations and stuff, and it's like, oh, wow, we've got this, you know, I don't know why this, and why is this guy so irritating? And he comes in, it's because he's so high status.
So I want to ask you a question.
He doesn't realize how high status he is, and that's actually getting in the way of getting people to do something, because you don't get people to do things by going, okay, I really like you. You know, I really, really like you. Everything about you is great, okay? So I just want you to know how much I trust you.
Right? So, Alan, I want to ask you a question. So I'm going back to marriages and the work, you know, basically unbalance all the marriages. We all of us have to be married. So let's say there was a couple where she was the low status and he was the high status. For 3 months, she's been alone with the kids.
Yeah.
Right? He's coming back and she's high status.
Yeah.
Can you give tips for like high status people that need to soften down?
Yes, absolutely. So high status, all those high status positions are based around openness in the body. Most high status people have real problems with checking behavior. Okay, think about it for a minute. What is flirting? What is flirting?
Low status, like little fidgety.
Banter?
Yeah, it is low status behavior where I am not asking the person to feel sorry for me. Okay, I am not asking them to feel sorry for me. I'm flirting with them. So I say I'm Brad Pitt Thelma and Louise. Right. Way back. Go back all way back.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So say I'm Brad Pitt and Thelma and Louise, and I forgot my hand on my hat, and I'm just checking, you know, just checking every now and then, just to see whether you're gonna, you know, look at me. I've got all this charm going, and you know, and I just feel like, you know, it's all that sort of stuff and all that charm. And well, I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I mean, I will, definitely, you know, right? You see, and that charm with a low status, it's like, oh, just want to put your arms around it, right?
Right.
So this is something where, as opposed to a high status person comes into the room and goes, yes, I love you. I do. I'm showing you that I love you. This is a highly aggressive, high status behavior, and it won't work. It's not going to be. So we cannot approach high status with high status. It just makes conflict.
So how do we help people that came, or a soldier that came back from high status, yeah, world where they're like this?
Yeah.
People soften and lower their status.
So I think the first step is to de-escalate the tension,
yeah,
right? Because that's if tension, I'm up and I'm there and so then if I can get to a relaxed place first, if I can come in and start interacting with the person that I love, not by meeting them head on and putting all my energy at them, but by coming up if you guys stand up again, I'm going to give you one little exercise to do. Okay.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Okay. So here's a little exercise for you. So, I'm going to get you to come in from that side. Yeah. Go off so I can't see you at all. Stage left. Yes. Go off stage left. All right. And I want you to come. Yeah. And I want you to come in. So, Galit, imagine that you've got there's an island, in between. You're washing dishes in the there's a sink in the island. You're washing dishes, so he can see you as he walks in. Okay.
Right here.
No, facing him.
Oh,
facing him. Okay. So, Asael, if you come in and just go head on, with your arms out like this.
Honey, I'm home from the war.
So look at what she tenses, her face goes, the muscles like, yeah, it's not comfortable at all, is it? So if you do the opposite of that, so first of all, at the door, you make a greeting, and then come around to the side so that you're on her area of influence.
To be in her area of influence.
Her area of influence, but don't try and do it head on.
Okay.
Come in from the side. Yeah. Right? No, that's it. And no closer than that. Don't get too close. Okay. You're a half step too close. There. That's better. And then let her. And then when she looks at you, look down and then up. Yeah. That's a check. Yeah. Okay. There. Yeah, isn't he irresistible?
Amazing.
Right? And it's just so much softer. So it's literally, all he's done is he's approached you in a low status way, but low status charming. Okay, he's approached you low status happy.
Yeah.
I'm seeing. That's a real key. Yeah, a non-threatening low status. Not low status pity me. Low status, it's okay.
Yeah.
So for that, I'm just thinking for the men who are listening to this, we need to A, de-roll from military survival.
Yeah.
And B, come with some joy or happiness. It's hard.
It's hard. It's hard. And it's really hard, but that's what you've got to do, because if you come in gangbusters hard, you'll get that reaction of like, you know, I've been here, da 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 da, and you've been out there, and you know how hard it's been not knowing whether you're gonna be around. Yeah,
all this
doing that's what we're getting.
Yeah.
So, Alan, can you give tips for women to go to, for people to raise status in a way that's not, because I've noticed that women raise status, they become militant, like screw you.
And yeah.
That the banana
the key to it is simply this. It's if you start thinking in a maternal way rather than in a confrontational way, you'll automatically connect with the other person rather than fight them.
Can you direct us cycle just
in okay. So same entrance. Same entrance, and then he comes in and can keep it real. Keep it. That's it. There we go. Yeah. So check up. And so Galit. So come up, relax your shoulders, and then look at him, and then smile, and just say, "I missed you."
I missed you.
And then land it. I missed you.
I missed you.
There you go. That's better. And that resonated with him. Did you see him move? Okay. So there's something about landing the thought as well. There's something about a maternal thing or paternal thing that is warmer. That's how you warm up high status. Yeah. And in fact, most people who are not good at high status they will always go aggressive, because it's at its core, it's not comfortable for them to be high status.
Because people have the default status, right? They have the default.
That's right. Yeah. So people have a default status of either high or low. And then often they're conditioned to be either that, and so it gets amplified, or they're conditioned in the opposite way. And it gets suppressed, okay? I had a student once who was deeply high status inside, but had been conditioned so hard low that she would go to a bank and she would kind of go, I'd like to take out some money, you know? So it would be, the reaction would be high, and then her response would be, because those are the only tools that she had learned.
Right. Especially by the way we socialize women.
Exactly. I think it's probably fair to say that at least historically, women have had to take that low status role. And it's only just starting to shift. And that's also, anytime we get a major transition like that, that also causes major conflicts, because you don't know where you are.
If I'm yes ending you, and if this is an opportunity for couples to renegotiate, we would see having women take more of a high status and men exploring low status in a happy and vulnerable way.
But there's the key to it: happy low status and relaxed high status.
Okay.
Happy low status, relaxed.
For men, low status means weak, sad, pity.
Yeah, and right. It doesn't. There's lots of great examples of men that use low status as their major tool to get things done. Right. In fact, I would argue that some of the greatest statesmen of all time have, in at least, they may have had a public high status thing that they played, but in private, they were great at low status transaction and got meetings done. Wow. You know, a good example of that, from everything I've heard, because I knew some people that actually knew him, was the British Prime Minister John Major came across so low status and weak on television and in public, but everybody said, yeah, but he's brilliant behind the scenes. Like, he's just brilliant behind the scenes. He gets so much done. Like, he was one of those guys who could get people to agree. And it's because he could kind of go, well, I'll be there and I'll do that sort of, you know.
I want you to connect. Before we call you, so you connected down to temperament. Could you tell us more about that and connect?
Yes, absolutely. So temperaments are really useful ways of helping us define traits that we have, tendencies of behavior. They're quite useful. They're like medieval Myers-Briggs, really, in the sense that, yeah, it is, in the sense, because it's really old. It goes back, I think, like Babylonian times. It's really, really old stuff. But so the idea was that, okay, in the old days, if they thought there were four elements, earth, air, fire, and water.
Right.
And then they connected personality traits to those four elements. So they said, okay, so people who are, determined, and they're strong-willed, and they're visionary, and they're optimistic, quite courageous, self-confidence, leader. I know. We notice that this form of behavior keeps happening with this. There's a pattern that's happening here. But we also notice that when they get a bit fearful and they start to go in, those are the outward signs of this temperament. But the inward signs of this temperament are they get a bit cold and unsympathetic, a bit, hostile and angry and kind of unforgiving and, domineering, opinionated, prejudiced, kind of proud and crafty in a way, right? So this is called the choleric temperament.
Right? Choleric?
Choleric temperament. And choleric...
Choleric meaning, sorry, I don't know that word.
So choleric comes from the word for heat, colon. Yeah, so the disease cholera is somebody that heats up too much. So they used to think, we talk about a hothead, that's described.
Right. In the clinic, we call it the thunderstorm. The thunderstorm.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But 100 seconds. 100, yeah. Yeah.
So these are choleric people, but we always have a secondary temperament as well. So there's our primary, and then there's our secondary.
Right.
But let's go through these four anyway. So that's choleric temperament. Then on the other hand, you have, the funny part about also cholericism as well is that if you go inward with it and you find all of those, hostile, angry, sarcastic, unforgiving, self-sufficient, this is all going disconnecting, right? Domineering, opinionated, proud, crafty. It kind of describes Donald Trump. So that tells you something about that character of that, about him, that he's very disconnected and he's very choleric.
Right.
And again, so that this is, again, we're getting away from good and evil here. We're just getting, you have these traits and you're disconnected. And that's kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I'm not saying you're evil or good. I'm just saying you are doing these things that are harming people because you're disconnected.
Yes. Yes.
There is only you. You're so self-absorbed that you're actually causing a lot of harm with what you do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But if you play the outside of that and you link to people, and you connect to people, then you get this wonderful, visionary, optimistic, courageous person, a great leader.
Yes.
Right? Fear is our worst enemy because fear is what disconnects us.
Fear disconnects, yes.
Fear disconnects us. So you can have great leaders who flip around the other way because they get fearful.
Yes.
And end up hurting people.
Yeah.
So that's the choleric. Well, that's the first.
That's choleric. That's our first one. So then we have the sanguine temperament. Sanguine coming from blood, okay. Mm-hmm. And this is so choleric is fire, obviously, right? Sanguine is air, and sanguine people they're really outgoing. They're charismatic. They're fun to be around. They're friendly. They're enthusiastic, carefree. They're compassionate. They're generous. that kind of thing. And they're warm, quite talkative, enthusiastic people, right? When they're on the outside, when they're connecting with people,
they're connected, yeah.
Yeah, when they're connected, they're doing all these wonderful things. When they're disconnected, though, they can seem a bit undisciplined. They can seem a bit weak-willed. So, sanguine people are the ones that oh, where's the party? They're like, oh, this is really great. Oh, look at that. That's really great too. Right. That's right. So it's like squirrel. Yes, exactly. That's right. You know, what I find fascinating is that modern modern kind of like the way that I think ADHD has been dealt with is basically taking all the sanguine people and giving them Ritalin. And that to me is problematic, but it's not, maybe not quite, you know, some people are so far off that you've got to do so. But for the most part, if you understand a sanguine person and understand what motivates a sanguine person, you can work within it. They just don't sit at a desk very well. So they're not very easy to educate because they're moving around all the time and playing with it, breaking pens and pencils and, you know, go, oh, look over there. You know, and then, you know, and then they get sent out in the hall and then, you know, right, do all their math right there. And meanwhile, they're in the hall, they're having a great time because they're like, look, I saw that outside, there was a bird, and it was like, you know, and all of that. Right. So, the downside of sanguine people is they can look disorganized and unproductive and undependable. They can feel a bit obnoxious and loud and get quite egocentric. They could also get kind of fearful and insecure. And if I like, did they not like me? Why did they not like me? How could they not like me? Right. It's a little bit like that, right? They get that kind of, they get persecuted. When they're disconnected, right?
Right.
So those are our top two. Those are air and fire people. And then the bottom of this temperament circle, melancholic people are connected to earth. Mm. I find that four element thing kind of useful just to think about because it kind of grounds it in a way. Like it says, oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, the choleric. What was that? Oh, yeah, the fiery guy. Yeah. Oh, sanguine. Oh, yeah, they're airy. They just bounce around all over the place, right? They're like a balloon. Right. Yeah. Right. And then, but then melancholic is kind of heavy. You know, it could be, oh, there's a noise that goes in like, oh. You know,
Eeyore
for Winnie the Pooh, classic melancholic. So, but the good part of melancholics is that they can be, when they're on the outside of the circle, they're really gifted. They're very analytical, solve problems. They're perfectionists. So they not only are analytical, but they're perfectionists. They can really solve the problem well. Conscientious, they get stuff done. They like figuring out problems, right? So, you know, there's a lot of melancholic in me, for instance. I looked at improv and I thought, what are the problems? How does that work? You know, that's classic melancholic.
Like researchers kind of unpack.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Researchers, philosophers, doctors, that kind of thing. Yeah, all that sort of stuff. Oh, yeah, yeah. There's some strong melancholic things going on there. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. So they're loyal. They have a real sense of the aesthetic, usually. Idealistic as well. Idealistic, sensitive people, very self-sacrificing. Ooh. And they have a great deal of self-discipline. This is on the outside of the circle.
Okay? Yes. Yeah.
On the inside of the circle, unfortunately, when things go wrong and they start cutting off the rest of the world, they get really moody and negative and critical and rigid and legalistic and quite self-centered and touchy. Yeah. You know, what do you want? You know, yeah, right? Vengeful. Gonna get you. Someday I'll get you. Right. Persecution from, what do you mean? What did they say? What did they say? Yeah. And unsociable, and they can get a little bit theoretical and impractical. You know, like, if we just do this, then it'll all work. And then the clerical go, why don't we just do this?
Yeah. That point, and then take the conversation we had this morning.
Yeah, of course. So, where's like, I have this plan, says the melancholic. I have this plan. It's amazing. Well, then the clerical goes, yeah, why don't you just, but you could just do this. Oh, yeah, that's right. We could just do that.
Yes, that's odd.
So understanding that is really helpful because then you don't get angry at a partner because they're being themselves.
Right.
Wow.
You don't get angry at them for being themselves. You know?
And I'm assuming when we're in survival mode, we go to the disconnected part of
our... Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We go to the disconnected part of our temperament. I mean, my personal belief, too, is that we are... Rudolf Steiner set up a whole movement of Waldorf schools.
Right.
And he used temperaments as his basis for how to kind of decode children and get the most out of them. That's where I first came across all of this work, because my kids went to a Waldorf school. And And it made them so self-reliant. It was amazing. Like when they came out, they just, well, they wanted something and they just did, so I need to do this, 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 and this. And it just, they had a level of self-reliance I hadn't seen in other kids. So it's a great system and it worked really well for them.
We're missing the fourth.
We're missing the fourth. The fourth is,
I told you melancholic sound of theory.
Yeah. So the fourth is phlegmatic. So this phlegmatic is water, phlegm. Right? Yeah. Come that. In medieval times, they were given all sorts of purges to purge out yellow bile and black bile and, you know, all that stuff, right? To get rid of too much phlegmatism in them. So the good side of a phlegmatic is that they can be quite calm and quiet, quite easygoing people. They're usually very likable. They see all the sides of a problem. So inevitably, if I'm working on this in a class with people and I start talking about the four temperaments, the phlegmatic will put their hand up and go, "But Alan, I'm all of these," right? Because they see all the sides of it, and it's very funny too. So, and it's quite interesting, you know. And you go, "Yes," and then everyone else will turn and go, "You're phlegmatic," right? And yeah, which I find very hilarious. They're likable people. They're very diplomatic because, as I say, they see all the sides of a problem. Phlegmatic people usually, when they see the cleric and the sanguine fighting in the corner, they'll usually come and go, hey guys, come on, let's, you know, calm us all down, right? So they're very useful people to have around, because they're efficient and they're organized, they're dependable, always on time, they always get it done. A little bit conservative in their approach, in the sense that they'll, you know, they're not going to take big risks. But it's like, okay, so conservatively, I can do this. Yeah, okay. But if we do this and we do that, then we're there. They're practical, right? Because, well, now we can't take that bigger risk because, you know, that's a thing. And they're reluctant leaders, but they're usually good leaders when they're convinced that they're the only person for the job, right? Which is how you motivate them. You know, you motivate a phlegmatic by saying you're the only person for the job. And they have quite a dry humor. Now, the bad part, or the disconnected part of a phlegmatic, is that they can look a bit unmotivated, because they sort of they'll check everything out because they're trying to weigh all the things. So they kind of go, no, I'm good. And they'll be just watching everybody. They look a little blasé because of that. They look a little indolent, like they're not doing anything because they're checking everything out. And that'd be a bit of a spectator. Can seem kind of, they can get selfish because it's like, no, I got to protect myself. You know, it's you know, financially and everything, right? Canada, and it's interesting, Canada is a very phlegmatic country, which is weird because it's right next to America, which is very, very choleric. Right. The U.S. is a very choleric country, and Canada is very, oh, geez, you know, those Americans, they're, you know, they're loud when they're, in, you know, they come across the border, and, you know, I try to be nice to them, but... you know, it's sometimes it's a challenge, you know. And phlegmatics can also seem a bit stingy. Well, you know, I don't know, sure I want to take that risk. And self-protective, stubborn, a bit indecisive, a bit fearful. Yeah. So, but they make great diplomats and accountants and teachers and technicians and people like, if anyone's got to figure it out. A lot of IT people are very phlegmatic. Because
is there a correlation between the four temperaments and status, or you can be anyone?
Yes. Yeah, I think, you can be a choleric and low status, but it's weird. Hmm. You know, most cholerics are high status. Most true cholerics, people that are actually not, I don't mean conditioned cholerics. I mean, somebody that's a true choleric tends to be higher in status. Because they see it, because the world is quite simple in the sense that, you know, I see a problem, I fix it. What's the big deal? You know, right? That's what a choleric does. They go, well, you know what? And if there's a vacuum in the room where everyone's going, I don't know what we're going to do. The choleric, okay, here's what we're going to do. Right? You know, and then I put it all together. Whereas, you know, but usually we're a combination of two of these temperaments. So you could be, for instance, I would classify myself as a choleric melancholic or melancholic choleric. And they switch around depending on what's happened to you. I, like with status, I think they switch around oftentimes public-private.
So
I'm more melancholic in private than I am in public. I'm much more choleric in public than I am
That's also your profession.
It's also my profession, exactly. But you know, the guy that can direct, the guy that can lead classes, the guy that can hold a room. That's the choleric guy.
Make people laugh.
Yeah.
That inside, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's the choleric guy that does that. The melancholic is the one that thinks about things, that writes poetry, that writes songs, that writes, you know, that writes philosophy. That's the melancholic part.
As we're starting to wrap up here, whoever's watching, please feel free to write questions or even open your mic. I'm thinking about, we spoke about, we both agree. I mean, we talk about that when there's hierarchy, there's no partnership. And I feel really like the world one couple at a time, couples need to we need to soften relational hierarchies.
So we can't eliminate status,
right?
But we can agree on the dance.
Right.
Well, say that again. Wait, say that again.
Yeah, so we can't eliminate status, but we can agree on the dance. We can agree the dance steps because, you know, I married you because there's a dance we like to play. The way you do stuff with me is fantastic. Yet think about great rom-coms just for a minute. Yeah. We talked for a minute before we were on air here about When Harry Met Sally, which is still probably my favorite rom-com of all time.
Right.
And I make no apologies for that. But what's great about that, there's a wonderful moment in it where right at the end of the big speech at New Year's Eve where Billy Crystal says, I like it when you wake up. I like the little snorting noise you make. I like it when you order your food, when you do this obsessive melancholic thing with your food. I like the crease in your forehead. You know, he's describing temperament details. But the status game that they play, he loves the status game and she does too. You know? And I think that's what's really interesting about it. We have this obsession, in a way, of we got to find the spark. And it isn't about the spark, it's about the dance. The dance is way more important than the spark. You know what I mean? Because the dance is what you have to do 20, 30, 40, 50 years with, right? The spark goes up and down. The flame, the passion flame goes up and down like a, well, in cycles. It's just us. You know, any long-term relationship is always like that. But the dance.
Yeah.
I got to have fun with my partner. You know, we joke each other. My partner and I joke all the time going we'll be doing something really silly and she'll turn to me and she'll go, no fun at all. And I think that's super healthy.
Would you say, so for couples coming back, we reconnecting, would you say a fun dance would necessitate that there is flexibility or?
Yes, I think so. It's gotta be, you know, what did I love about you? What is it I loved about your crazy habits? What is it I love about the way you go, what is it I love about all of those little things? It's all the little stuff. That's all part of the little status dance back and forth. You know, I think couples start to fall apart too when they get, so there's one thing, crisis causes problems because it adjusts your status and you come back with something like, you know, you come back from those terrible things and you have PTSD, it's hard to play those games. So those are the things that we've got to look at. How can we release that so that we can start playing those games again? Because having fun, having the games going, it doesn't matter what hell we have to go through, but we have to be playing those games with each other. We have to be having those fun status transactions with each other. Because if we miss that, it's so important. If we miss that, we miss those beautiful
disconnection.
Yeah, we go to disconnection. Yeah, and what is PTSD but another form of disconnection? Because it's because you can't cope with the horror that you've experienced, so you disconnect. And no wonder people fall apart. No wonder people fall apart. We shouldn't be surprised at this at all.
Thinking a lot about what it felt like, right? Like in terms of energy and embodying it and the difference between when he came head on, when it came head on versus when he came to the side. And I'm thinking about what you're saying about kind of having fun and playing with the status. In other words, recognizing what I'm hearing you say essentially is the part of playing with the status is stripping it of this value of better, worse, good, bad, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and on top of that, stripping it of I'm doing this against your will.
Right, for sure.
You know, you think about those moments when you will not do that.
Right.
I'm going to assert my status and I'm going to lower your status against your will. That causes pain and anxiety every time.
Okay, so you just kind of, that was a great segue in that I think part of what maybe needs to be rekindled is for helping couples soften, because they're reuniting when there's a lot of that, where there's a lot of that either rigidity, nobody's playing with statuses, or there's been a force with status, right? When you come back from war, when you come back from any state of kind of violence, that's I will assert my status on others because I have, because that's survival, right? Kind of like, and so this like stripping it of the better, worse, bigger, stronger.
I think that's really important, because whenever somebody is injured, either mentally or physically, they need to know that what they come back to is safe. And safety means that I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to adjust your status against your will.
Yeah.
And harm you. I talk about Steiner again. It's quite interesting. So he was a crazy mystic anyway, and had this idea, you know, that the life force actually gets injured. The etheric force gets injured when we energetically hurt people, not just physically, but when we energetically hurt people.
Our life force, hurting.
Yeah. That the person hurting, the other person's life force gets injured as well as the person that they're hurting.
Wow. Yeah. So that kind of coming softly is already, I'm not coming in force to play status games, but that kind of connection.
Yeah. So for couples watching this, if they're noticing that the status game is rigid and they're always one down or always one up, then that means it's time. We need to re-explore that. That's what you're saying.
You need to start to learn to play again.
Yeah.
You need to learn to start to play again.
Or play, period. Some of them.
Or play, period. Yeah, you may never have played. It may have been, I married you because, it's all very clear. And,
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So there's so much. I mean, this is such a huge thing. But like I say, for me, I really do like the temperament work, and I like how it fits. So, a melancholic can often be, we talked about how all these different temperaments, we said there is a connection, I think, between choleric and high status. And I think there's a connection between low status and melancholy, and low status and phlegmatics. You often see low status phlegmatics because they don't want to assert themselves into things.
Right, right,
but
right.
They often appear low status until they're granted status, and then they accept it. It's a very interesting thing. It's like when you say to somebody, you're the only person for this job, and they take the mantle of leadership and really go with it, it surprises everybody that, oh, wow, I didn't know he could do that, or I didn't know she could do that, right?
It's really, I also thinking, and if any people, that was the time to ask before we wrap up, but I'm thinking we're right now in a very rigid status reality.
Yeah.
We're asking couples within the boundary of your home to basically rebel against reality, which is right now very hierarchical, very,
rigid. Very hierarchical. Yeah.
And then you're saying what I'm hearing you, what I'm taking from this is also safety.
Yeah.
And also to be flexible, to play, and to say, okay, let's try this and take two and let's cut, rewind.
Yeah. And I'm not saying this is easy because, people are damaged, and damaged people will lash out. Damaged people will inadvertently, if you're disconnected and you're damaged, then you will do things and hurt your partner without realizing you're doing it because you have disconnected.
Right.
I cannot hurt you if I'm connected.
But connected means I need to see your subjectivity.
I need your subjectivity. Yeah, totally. So yeah.
I love the whole like connected, disconnected, and love and fear too.
Yeah.
So Billy, let's do our closing round. What's one thing you're taking from today, Billy? A thought, question. And then Alan, I'll close up and we'll do a closing.
Well, I'm taking so much because it really kind of like, I loved how you said something when you were describing the four elements, and you said that it allows, you know, when we've kind of recognized who we are and who our partners are, then it allows us to love them wholly for all that they are, right? Including annoying parts and things like that. And I love that. And I feel like oftentimes when we kind of, not label, but when we kind of, you know, identify people as having certain traits and having certain qualities, it gets misused when actually it's not supposed to kind of just like disregard the behavior, but rather give us another element of wholly connecting to them.
Totally. Right?
Like a tool to connect even more.
Yes, exactly.
You in a much more whole kind of way. And I know that you're not doing it to spite me it's not about me. It's about the person in front of me.
Yeah.
So I love that.
Gosh, it makes it so much easier when you understand, when you kind of go, oh, that was like, oh, I see what's happening there.
Yeah. It's like, so you can see it accurately.
It just aids a little bit. It just helps a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Alan, closing thoughts before I wrap up the session today.
So for me, it's really about, I really think that access of love and fear is the real key to everything is that if I can, and when I mean love, it's not just, sometimes we think of love as just romantic love. And that's kind of like, that's attached love, mm-hmm. You know? And it's really about, it's the more selfless you can be with the love that you feel,
yeah,
the more you can connect. Because I think that we, you know, the scary part, we get to fear. And then we go, but I want what I had. And you try and attach really hard to it. And it just pushes it farther away by trying to attach to it, grab onto it. I must have it. You know, this happens when 20-year-olds leave the nest, and the mom goes, I want to be part of your life. You know, I want to be part of your life. Right? When can I come and visit? When are you visiting me? Why haven't you phoned?
That's right.
And it's a weird attachment thing, whereas it's too easy to get into that place and just go, you know what? I just unconditionally love this thing, and to get to that, and then we can start to really move mountains.
Mm.
That's what I think, anyway.
I want to share. I want to share with you, Alan, and you believe. Like I think this conversation. I've known you. I've seen you perform, and I've studied with you. And usually the improv that I've seen you has always been performing and comedy and also drama. And I think today what I'm taking is. And maybe that's what drew me to improv. It's a way to change the world, to heal the world.
Yeah, I think so.
It's a social revolution. It's a social, almost like a peace activist. And I really want to thank you today because it was fascinating for me to see your more philosophical. I mean, obviously, genius now all talks about Einstein and the way you change the world, right? But
yeah.
I think what I'm really taking from this, improv is a way to not only have fun and play, but it's really it's a tool for connection.
Yeah, I really think that's its greatest thing. I'm about to embark. I've started another workshop here in Wimbledon in South London, but I'm about to embark also on a weekly program of working with 55 plus to help brain plasticity, and work on getting people to hold back dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that using improv as a tool to help ignite that, to help.
And And I really want to, it's been fascinating to see your work evolve and develop as you mature and sage. And this is a great, anybody want, Alan, people want to study with you, read your book, how did they get to you? I'm going to put the link in the recording, but if you want to share.
Sure. So you can contact me on my Squarespace website. There's a contact detail there. That's the easiest place to you know, if you want to do work with me and stuff, then I can give you details of that. Now, also, all the stuff that I'm doing is there too. So alan-marriott.com is my website. So just check that out there.
I'm going to put the link there and obviously order this book. It's genius. Yeah. And Rochelle says, this was absolutely fascinating. I'm a somatic psychotherapist and huge improv fan. Would love to stay connected. Philippe, and we want, I think for me personally, I want to, on a personal note, I think my whole adult life, I've only been reading improv and therapy books and kind of connecting you and bringing you here and having these two worlds combined is truly a magical.
Well,
everyone was listening to us or watching us, use the status ideas, read about it, play with it, you know, maybe move from disconnection to connection, fear to love.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here. So
thank you so much. Thank you. I'm wishing everyone love and connection.
And play.
And play.
Play. Oh,
so thanks, God. Everyone.
Thank you.
Good night.
Take care. Night.